Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record, program number 741, Update on the Meltdown, Part 7, Bail, Bail, the Gang's All Here. This program is being recorded on April 23rd of the year 2011. We're going to plunge right in where we, in a sense, left off in For the Record 740. We were talking about Wachovia and its laundering of vast amounts of money for Mexican drug cartels, a sum equal to roughly a third of the gross national product of Mexico. That, in turn, was inextricably linked with the operations that Daniel Hopsicker has been chronicling for us on and off for a number of years. In the article, actually a London Observer article that was run by The Guardian, it's called How a Big U.S. Bank Laundered Billions from Mexico's Murderous Drug Gangs, and it contains a quote here from Antonio Maria Costa, who was executive director of the U.N.'s Office on Drugs and Crime. And he said, he's quoted here, "The connection between organized crime and financial institutions started in the late 1970s and early 1980s when the mafia became globalized," unquote. Then two things happened, skipping down, the financial crisis in Russia after the emergence of the Russian mafia and the crises of 2003 and 2007 and 8. With these crises, says Costa, the banking sector was short of liquidity. The banks exposed themselves to the criminal syndicates who had cash in hand. And then talking about this, Mr. Woods, the Wachovia London branch investigator who helped to uncover this wrongdoing and who was basically leaned on in no uncertain terms by Wachovia, went on to describe the effects of this. New York and London, says Woods, have become the world's two biggest laundries of criminal and drug money and offshore tax havens. Not the Cayman Islands, not the Isle of Man or Jersey. The big laundering is right through the city of London and Wall Street. After the Wachovia case, no one in the regulatory committee has sat down with me and asked, what happened or what can we do to avoid this happening to other banks? They're not interested. They're the same people who attacked the whistleblowers, and this is a position the British Financial Services Authority at least has adopted on legal advice. It has been advised that the confidentiality of banking and bankers takes primacy over the Public Information Disclosure Act. That is how the priorities work, secrecy first, public interest second. Meanwhile, the drug industry has two products, money and suffering. And remember that it was in July of 2007 when these investigations were going on that the funny money from the Mexican CDCs, the Casas de Cambio, began to dry up. And a lot of other things were drying up, too, including short-term lending to a number of the troubled financial institutions. Recently, there was a disclosure of documents by the Federal Reserve Bank, and it disclosed a number of interesting things. Now, we're going to be taking a look once again at Wachovia. In a sense, we're kind of going to dolly out with the camera, and we're not only going to take a look at Wachovia, but we're going to be taking a look at what was happening with Wall Street and the Federal Reserve right in the period of time when Wachovia was getting ready to go belly up and they were losing the access to the Mexican drug capital. That was in July and August of 2007. A New York Times article of April 3rd of 2011 by Gretchen Morgenson, actually April 2nd of 2011 by Gretchen Morgenson, called "The Bank Run We Knew So Little About," and it reads, "In August of 2007, as world financial markets were seizing up, domestic and foreign banks began lining up for cash from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. That August 20th, Commerzbank of Germany borrowed $350 million at the Fed's discount window. 2 days later, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and the Wachovia Corporation each received $500 million. As collateral for all these loans, the bank put up a total of $213 billion in asset-backed securities, commercial loans, and residential mortgages, including second liens. Thus began the bank run that set off the financial crisis of 2008, but unlike other bank runs, this one was invisible to most Americans. Until last week, that is, when the Fed pulled back the curtain. Responding to a court ruling, it made public thousands of pages of confidential lending documents from the crisis. The data dump arose from a lawsuit initiated by Mark Pittman, a reporter at Bloomberg News, who died in November of 2009. Don't know anything about the man's death, but listen to this. The data dump, right, this huge disclosure, and it really, really is a monumental disclosure. The data dump arose from a lawsuit initiated by Mark Pittman, a reporter at Bloomberg News who died in November of 2009. Upon receiving his request for details on the central bank's lending, the Fed argued that the public had no right to know. The courts disagreed. The Fed documents, like much of the information about the crisis that has been pried out of reluctant government agencies, reveal what was going on behind the scenes as the financial storm gathered. For instance, they show how dire the banking crisis was becoming during the summer of 2007. Washington policymakers, meanwhile, were saying that the subprime crisis would reside with little impact on the broad economy and that world markets were highly liquid. For example, on July 23, 2007, Henry M. Paulson, Jr., the Treasury Secretary at the time, said the housing slump appeared to be, quote, at or near the bottom, unquote. 2 days later, Timothy F. Geithner, then the president of the New York Fed, declared in a speech before the Forum on Global Leadership in Washington, unquote, financial markets outside the United States are now deeper and more liquid than they used to be, making it easier for companies to raise capital domestically at a reasonable cost, unquote. Within about a month's time, however, foreign banks began thronging to the Fed's discount window, its mechanism for short-term lending to banks. Over 4 days in late August and early September, foreign institutions, through their New York branches, received a total of almost $1.7 billion in Fed loans. As the global run progressed, banks increased their borrowings, the documents show. For example, on September 12, 2007, Citibank drove up to the New York Fed's window. It extracted $3.375 billion of cash in exchange for $23 billion worth of assets, including commercial mortgage-backed securities, residential mortgages, and commercial loans. That transaction seemed to get the Fed's attention. At 1:30 that afternoon, Mr. Geithner spent half an hour on the phone with Gary L. Crittenden, Citi's chief financial officer at the time, Mr. Geithner's calendar shows. A few weeks later, Citigroup announced that it was writing off $5.9 billion in the third quarter, causing its profit to drop 60% from a year earlier, and that was only the beginning. Perhaps the biggest revelation in the Fed documents is the extent to which the central bank was willing to lend to foreign institutions. On November 8, 2007, Deutsche Bank took out $2.4 billion and a $2.4 billion overnight loan secured by $4 billion in collateral. And on December 5, 2007, Caillon of France borrowed $2 billion, providing $16 billion in collateral. When the crisis was full on in 2008, foreign institutions became even bigger beneficiaries of the Fed's credit programs. On November 4th of that year, the Fed extended $133 billion through various facilities. Now, note these next two institutions, because we're going to come back to these in a second. Two foreign institutions, the German-Irish Bank DEPFA, D-E-P-F-A, and Dexia Credit of Belgium, received 39% of the money on that day being November 4th of 2008. Keep an eye on these two institutions. We're going to come back to them. DEPFA, the German-Irish Bank, and Dexia Credit of Belgium, part of the Baron Lambert of Drexel Burnham Lambert fame in Luxembourg, and we're going to talk more about that in a second. The striking thing was the large amount of borrowing that the New York Fed accepted during the crisis from European banks that had only a minimal presence in the United States and arguably pose no threat to the U.S. payment system, said Walker F. Todd, a research fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research and a former assistant general counsel and research officer at the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland. Such a thing would never have occurred 20 years ago, he added. All of the discount window borrowings extended to institutions during the debacle have been repaid, but the precedent was set. The Fed was the financial backstop to the world. Since 2000 or so, the mindset of the Fed in New York and Washington has been that the central bank must step in when there is a global crisis, Mr. Todd said, that even if it appears to extend its mandate. Ben S. Bernanke, the Fed chairman, seemed to foreshadow this view early in the crisis. Addressing the Fed's annual symposium at Jackson Hole, Wyoming on August 17, 2007, Mr. Bernanke said, It is not the responsibility of the Federal Reserve, nor would it be appropriate to protect lenders and investors from the consequences of their financial decisions. But developments in financial markets can have broad economic effects felt by many outside of the market, said the Federal Reserve, which must take those effects into account when determining policy. Protecting global lenders and investors from the effects of their financial decisions was exactly what the Fed decided it had to do. Bankers and investors on the receiving end of this largesse have long known the extent to which the Fed rescued them in their time of need. Now, thanks to these Fed documents, the rest of us can see it too. Now, again, note those two institutions I highlighted. Dexia, that's a Luxembourg-based company. It's part of the Baron Lambert complex in Luxembourg. Luxembourg, by the way, a long-standing money laundering center. It also is inextricably linked with the Bormann Capital Network, about which I've spoken so often, in the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning, available for download for free on the SpitfireList.com website. There's a long section about Luxembourg. You can also read that in, for the record, 305, an excerpting of the text. Those two banks, Dexia, part of the Lambert Banque Internationale de Luxembourg, and also the DEPFA Group, D-E-P-F-A, that is a German-Irish bank and one of the Landesbanks, as they're called. Now, those were two of the institutions that received a lot of the Fed's borrowing. And as we're going to see, what that basically did was to bail them out, and in so doing, saving U.S. municipal bonds and perhaps state debt as well, apparently state debt as well, because those two banks had basically been engaged in what appears to have been some illegal financial machinations vis-a-vis that municipal and perhaps state debt. So it was basically what Dexia and DEPFA were apparently doing was engaging in criminal activity, which helped to bankrupt them, so then we bail them out, or courtesy the Federal Reserve bails them out. It now turns out that the loophole that was used to bail out these foreign banks, or not so much a loophole, but the provision which was utilized to bail out these banks by extending them loans, has basically been on the books for a long, long time. We, however, did not know about it. This is an article from Bloomberg News by Bob Ivry, I-V-R-Y, April 5th, 2011. Fed's biggest foreign bank bailout saved U.S. muni bonds. A European bank that received the most Federal Reserve discount window help during the financial crisis also took $381 billion in aid from its home countries and owned subsidiaries implicated in bid rigging that prosecutors say defrauded U.S. taxpayers. Details of Fed lending released last week show that Dexia SA, or DEXB, based in Brussels and Paris, borrowed as much as $37 billion with an average daily loan amount of $12.3 billion in the 18 months after Lehman Brothers Holdings Incorporated collapsed in September of 2008. The House subcommittee that oversees the Fed plans hearings on the central bank's discount window lending to offshore financial institutions next month. By lending to Dexia, again, that's the Luxembourg bank, the Fed kept money flowing into local government projects throughout the U.S., as well as the money market funds that invested in them. Dexia-guaranteed bonds issued by entities as varied as the Texas State Veterans Land Board in Austin and the Los Angeles County Metropolitan Transportation Authority. Quote, if Dexia went bankrupt, it could have been a catastrophe for municipal finance and money funds, said Matt Fabian, a Concord, Massachusetts-based senior analyst and managing director at Municipal Markets Advisors, an independent research company. Again, quoting, the market has extensive exposure to foreign banks, unquote. Note that for future reference. Overseas banks accounted for 70% of discount window loans when borrowing reached its peak of $113.7 billion in October of 2008, according to the Fed's data. The discount window established in 1914 is known as the lender of last resort. By law, most U.S. branches of foreign banks have access to the discount window, said David Skidmore, a spokesman for the American Central Bank. They are important providers of credit to U.S. businesses and households, and discount window lending during the financial crisis helped support their continued lending in the United States, he said. The Fed has kept discount window borrowers secret for 97 years. Last week's disclosures were court-mandated after legal victories by Bloomberg LP, the parent of Bloomberg News, and News Corp's Fox News Network LLC. DEPFA Bank PLC, a German-owned bank based in Dublin, Ireland, was another insurer of municipal bonds in the U.S. DEPFA's discount window borrowing peaked at $28.5 billion in November of 2008. Dexia, which borrowed $37 billion from the discount window in January of 2009, said its loans from the European Central Bank peaked at 122 billion euros or $173 billion in October of 2008. That month, it also received about $200 billion in debt guarantees and $8 billion in cash infusions from Belgium, France, and Luxembourg. The bank availed itself of other Fed lending programs, too. Its total borrowings from the U.S. Central Bank's commercial paper funding facility ranked third among users of the emergency program created to support the market for short-term debt that was issued by banks and corporations. Dexia used the program 42 times for a total of $53.5 billion, according to the data the Fed released in December. Dexia also tapped the term auction facility, the lending mechanism the Fed established in December of 2007 to augment the discount window. Dexia received 24 TAF loans totaling $105.2 billion, the largest of which was $16.7 billion on January 7, 2008, the Fed data show. The lender used TAF about twice a month from December 2007 to December 2008, then once in August 2009 and once more in November of 2009. The interest rates it paid ranged from 4.65% in December of 2007 to 0.25% for the two loans in 2009. The Fed loans have been repaid, said Ulrika Pomme, a Brussels-based Dexia spokeswoman. The bank used the Fed's emergency lending facilities to finance U.S. assets only, Pomme said in an email statement. Quote, "We have always been very transparent in our communications about the wear and tear on us in the market during the crisis," Pomme said. In 2008, Dexia was hit with buyback provisions in municipal bonds, Pomme said. The bank was one of the biggest backstops of the bonds, providing letters of credit or so-called standby purchase agreements, guarantees to buy the bonds if investors wanted out. Dexia's so-called credit enhancement made it possible for money market funds to buy the bonds. Dexia provided $14.7 billion in standby agreements and letters of credit in North and South America, excluding Mexico, in the first half of 2008, a six-fold increase over the same period a year earlier, the bank said in its first half 2008 report. The growth was the direct result of a dwindling number of market participants able to offer such financial products, combined with the urgent needs of issuers to restructure their debt, Dexia said. Over most of the last decade, thousands of cities, counties, hospitals, and universities issued long-term floating-rate bonds and paired them with interest rate swaps to try to protect against higher borrowing costs. The strategy, which relied on banks such as Dexia to guarantee a market for the variable rate notes, collapsed when investment firms and bond insurers lost their top credit ratings. Interest rate swaps are derivatives or contracts whose values are derived from assets, including stocks, bonds, currencies, and commodities, or from events such as changes in interest rates or the weather. Swaps are private contracts, and the market for them isn't regulated. Redemptions sapped Dexia so much that the bank was, quote, 2 days from bankruptcy, unquote, Pomme said, citing the French Ministry for the Economy. Dexia's lifeline from U.S. taxpayers came as federal officials were investigating allegations that Dexia's subsidiaries colluded with others to defraud state and local governments. Two former Dexia units were among more than a half dozen financial firms that conspired to pay below-market interest rates to U.S. state and local governments on so-called guaranteed investment contracts, or GICs, according to documents filed in a U.S. Justice Department criminal antitrust case. Municipalities buy GICs with money raised by selling bonds, allowing them to earn a return until the funds are needed for schools, roads, and other public holdings. An employee of Financial Security Assurance Holdings Limited, one of the Dexia subsidiaries, agreed to pay kickbacks ranging from $4,500 to $475,000 to a Los Angeles investment broker called CDR Financial Products Incorporated in exchange for rigging bids, according to people familiar with the case and public records. CDR employees fed information on competitors' bids to FSA, allowing the firms to win deals at a lower interest rate than it would have paid, according to a federal indictment, public records, and the people. Stephen Goldberg, a former FSA banker, was indicted in July on fraud and conspiracy charges. He has pleaded not guilty. FSA, which hasn't been indicted, is facing a lawsuit from the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. While Dexia sold the bond insurance unit of FSA, it remained exposed to legal risks because it kept another division of the company, its financial products segment, Dexia said in its third quarter report. Dexia has said its funding from the European Central Bank remained at 18 billion euros in February of 2011. Still, its borrowing with the Fed, quote, was a temporary situation and now they're trading just fine, unquote, said Nat Singer of Swap Financial Group LLC, in South Orange, New Jersey. So basically, we were bailing them out to keep the resulting financial collapse from collapsing American municipalities and states and other institutions. Turns out that they were engaged in criminal wrongdoing, apparently, at the very same time conspiring to defraud their clients. Interestingly enough, there are a number of indications that yet another financial collapse may be upon us, and if, in fact, that produces something very similar to what we've seen, or something in any way similar to it, guess who may be left on the hook again, okay? That doesn't sound like a whole lot of fun at all. This following story is a story from the Bloomberg News Service once again. It's by Aaron Kirschfeld and Serena Sato from January 28th of 2011. This quotes Josef Ackermann, the chairman of Deutsche Bank, or the chief executive officer of Deutsche Bank, saying that basically with the financial risks that are on the horizon, if the hedge funds go belly up, the public may have to bail out the hedge funds as well. Again, from Bloomberg, from January 28th of 2011, Deutsche Bank AG Chief Executive Officer Josef Ackermann said unregulated financial companies such as hedge funds may pose a systemic risk to the economy if oversight isn't increased. Quote, you have an unregulated area which becomes, as a consequence of all the regulatory changes, more and more important, Ackermann 62 said in an interview at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. You may one day wake up and realize that the systemic challenges are so big that you will have to bail out or at least help support the unregulated sector, unquote. Ackermann's warning echoes comments made by former U.S. Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers, who said this week in Davos that regulators haven't paid enough attention to problems that could emerge in a, quote, large, less healthy buccaneer sector. Hedge funds have dodged the brunt of new global banking regulation aimed at avoiding a repeat of the worst global financial crisis since the Great Depression. If you separate utility banks from casino banking, you will one day realize that casino banks are also counterparts to corporations, but also to other banks and asset management and to governments, unquote. Ackermann said yesterday, again quoting, it would be somewhat naive to assume that if you have a strong regulated sector and leave the unregulated in the open, that you will never have systemic risk, unquote. In other words, what he's saying is that with the apparent risk that's unfolding, if something isn't done, we're going to have to bail out the hedge funds in order to avoid a total collapse. And that's going to be interesting as well. Yet another Bloomberg story, Bloomberg News story, this from Andrew Fry of February 11th of 2011. Warren Buffett has weighed right in, and I think he's Jimmy Buffett, singer Jimmy Buffett's either uncle or cousin. I'm not sure which. But in any event, Warren Buffett has weighed in, and here's what he has to say about the looming financial situation, shall we euphemize it. He's saying basically that already it's too late. that too big to fail is a reality, and that if it happens, well, we're just going to have to bail out these big institutions. Again, from Bloomberg News Service of February 11, 2011, Warren Buffett, the billionaire chairman of Berkshire Hathaway Incorporated, told the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission that taxpayers will always be on the hook for collapses at the biggest U.S. companies. Quote, "You will always have institutions that are too big to fail, and sometimes they will fail," Buffett, 80, told the FDIC in a May 26th interview, according to a recording released by the panel yesterday. "We still have them now, and we'll have them after your commission report," unquote. The Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act enacted in July was touted by President Barack Obama as a means to ending bailouts and protecting taxpayers from firms that are too big to fail. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben S. Bernanke, who made more than $3 trillion of assistance available during the crisis, has said that the, quote, "too big to fail" issue can be eliminated only when investors believe the U.S. won't rescue firms. Investors were rescued in 2008 by Bernanke and then Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, whose relief programs cushioned declines for stockholders and bailed out bondholders at firms such as American International Group. And so Warren Buffett saying basically it's too late to stop, too big to fail. And failed things just might. There is a vulgar military slang acronym, BOHICA, B-O-H-I-C-A. Basically, it stands for Bend Over, Here It Comes Again. And in the news and supplemental section on the SpitfireList.com website, I have a number of posts under the general heading of BOHICA, and I'm going to run through a few of these. This is an article from ABC News, March 2nd of 2010. Economists, another financial crisis on the way, reading in part, even as many Americans still to recover from the country's worst economic downturn from the Great Depression, another crisis, one that will be even worse than the current one, is looming, according to a new report from a group of leading economists, financiers, and former federal regulators. Worse, is it? Terrific. A Wall Street Journal article, BOHICA, Part 2, Wall Street Journal article by Mark Gongloff, David Enrich, and Sarah Schaefer Munoz, European Bank Lenders, Coalition of Unwilling. And what this is talking about is the dry up of short-term lending to a lot of European banks. That is serious, if not fatal, to financial institutions and could lead to the failure of European banks. And guess who's going to bail those out or lend them money? Basically, the article reads in part, lenders to the major European banks are growing increasingly cautious, demanding higher rates for shorter periods, adding further stress to an already fragile financial system. Worries about sovereign debt have caused banks and other investors to pare risk. At the same time, new restrictions on money market funds, which are big lenders to the banks, are forcing them to pull back on their lending. There's an awful lot of red ink on those European banks' books. Bloomberg.com article by Gaby Tasing. Banks' overnight deposits with ECB increased to record update. Again, relates to the dry up in funds for these particular banks with a lot of red ink on their books. Overnight deposits with the European Central Bank rose to a record yesterday as the sovereign debt crisis made banks wary of lending to each other. This, in certain respects, mirrors what was happening in the run-up to the collapse of 2007-2008. And this is interesting, too. This is from Financial Times of February 18th of 2001. Junk bonds yields at record low by Alan Von Dean and Nicole Bullock. Interest rates on junk bonds or high-yielding debt have hit an all-time low of 6.8%, fueled by investor appetite for riskier assets amid growing evidence that a U.S. recovery is underway. And this, too, a drop in the yield by junk bonds was very much characteristic of this is similar to what was going on in the run-up to the collapse of the financial industry in 2007-2008. And basically that high risk is being sought because of relatively low interest rates elsewhere. So junk bond yields at another low. Is that signaling a meltdown? If so, we know who's coming to the rescue, don't we? Anyway, this concludes For the Record 741. Bail, bail, the gang's all here. Or update on the meltdown, part 7. Bail, bail, the gang's all here. This is being recorded on April 23rd of the year 2011. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.